This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. Hoping you're having a great long holiday weekend. Joining me on today's program, I have two special guest experts joining me in segments 2 and 3 on today's program. Best-selling author, Mr. Harry Dent, and joining me momentarily, and in the fourth segment of today's program, Mr. Ian Gordon of the Longwave Group. I know you're going to find the conversations that I have had with both of these gentlemen fascinating, and they offer some insights that I believe are going to be vital to understanding how to manage your personal finances moving ahead. If you would like more information on an ongoing basis from us, I would invite you to become a subscriber to our Portfolio Watch newsletter. You can do that by visiting the website, yourretirementoutlook.com. The website, again, is yourretirementoutlook.com. I am pleased to have as a returning guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Ian Gordon. Ian is president and founder of the Longwave Group. If you've been a longtime listener to the Everything Financial Radio program, you'll recognize Ian's name, and I always look forward to our conversation together. Ian, welcome back to the program.
I'm happy to be with you.
Ian, in the past we have talked about the ongoing devaluation of paper currency and ultimately what we both believe will obviously be a failure of paper currencies. Since we've last talked a few months ago, can you just talk to the listeners about maybe what's been going on in the world that confirms that we are still headed in that direction?
Well, you know, I really don't think there's any doubt that we are headed in that direction. I mean, paper money is debt money, and debt money is being piling on debt to the tune that the overall debt in the world is now $200 trillion. There's no way that that money can ever be repaid. The world GDP is approximately about $65 trillion. So that's an impossibility. In other words, the world economies cannot basically function to effectively pay back the debt. And the U.S. is simply the world's largest debtor nation, owing better than $18.2 trillion, and that money can never be repaid. The U.S. GDP, which includes the U.S. government contribution to the economy, is a little less than the total debt. So the total U.S. government debt is now better than 100% of GDP. So there's no way that that debt will ever be repaid. And in fact, what's happening is that many countries who own U.S. debt, like China, Russia, and so on, have been reducing their debt holdings of U.S. debt. So the dollars, you know, together with the debt problems for the U.S., the U.S. also has real problems facing the dollar as the world's reserve currency and its petrodollar status.
Ian, let me talk a bit about something you just mentioned, that China is reducing its holdings of U.S. government debt. I think it was a Bloomberg story about a month ago that said that China reduced its holdings of U.S. government debt by $250 billion or a quarter of $1 trillion. And yet we didn't see a tremendous spike in interest rates. How do you explain that?
Well, it appears that that debt is being basically purchased by the Federal Reserve. So the Federal Reserve can create money out of nothing, and it effectively puts the U.S. debt on the Federal Reserve's book. So the Federal Reserve now has massive amounts, not only of U.S. debt, but all sorts of other holdings such as mortgage-backed securities and so on. So the Federal Reserve has just been creating money to effectively purchase this debt. That's why you really haven't seen the dollar under any extreme pressure. In fact, the dollar's been strengthening against other currencies. And because the U.S. Federal Reserve, or the Federal Reserve, let's not call it the U.S. because an independent private bank consortium, you know, is purchasing that debt.
Ian, that seems like a very dangerous thing to do, to create literally money out of thin air or intangible money, if you will, and exchange it for tangible goods and services. And it seems that that ongoing exchange of intangible for tangible will have to come to a screeching halt when those trading the tangible stuff or the intangible stuff come to the realization that they don't want to do that anymore. Are we close to that?
Well, you know, but everybody's doing it. I mean, the European Central Bank is doing the same thing. It's purchasing debt. And so the Japanese government's purchasing debt. It's even purchasing Japanese stocks through ETFs and so on. So all the central banks, this is the act of desperation that's going on to try to preserve the fiat currency systems worldwide. And the people that effectively aren't playing in that game are countries like China and Russia that have been accumulating gold at a rapid pace, because I think they, you know, they obviously know that effectively that the paper money system, worldwide paper money system, is doomed.
So, Ian, you know, often when historically you've seen this process happen, that money's literally created out of thin air, it follows that there are geopolitical tensions, and certainly there's no shortage of that around the world today. Do you see the end game being something like maybe we saw following the 1930s, where there was a worldwide conflict?
Well, I think that's a very dangerous sort of supposition, because a worldwide conflict today effectively will result in a nuclear war, because even if you go to a conventional war, you know, the losing side is going to resort to the nuclear option. And so, and obviously that would effectively destroy us all. So I think that, you know, hopefully saner heads will prevail you know, not go that route. And effectively, you know, a new system is going to evolve. A new monetary system is going to evolve. It always does. You know, my work is governed by cycles, and it always does at this stage in the cycle. So we are going to see a new monetary system evolve. And, you know, if you go back to the previous periods in the long wave cycle, you can always see that at what we call the winter of the cycle, a new system evolves. And, you know, so I'm pretty well convinced that the new system will be gold-backed, because the fiat paper money system is collapsing.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for this segment. Our guest today is Mr. Ian Gordon of the Long Wave Group. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. And as I mentioned at the outset of today's program, I will be continuing my conversation with Mr. Ian Gordon of the Long Wave Group in the fourth segment of today's program. Joining me momentarily will be Mr. Harry Dent, best-selling author. And before I get to my conversation with Harry, let me again remind you on this long holiday weekend, if you'd like to get more information from us on an ongoing basis, you'd like to see what our analysis of the markets and the economy is, then you may want to become a subscriber to the Portfolio Watch newsletter. It's easy to do. Just visit the website, yourretirementoutlook.com. The website is yourretirementoutlook.com. Give us your name and email address, and we will sign you up. I'm pleased to have as a returning guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Harry Dent. Harry is a best-selling author. His most recent book is titled The Demographic Cliff, and he is offering the listeners a free copy of the book. You pay only $4.95 shipping and handling, and you can go to harrydent.com to request it. And Harry, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, nice to be back, Dennis.
Harry, talk about, if you would, the premise of your book, The Demographic Cliff.
Well, you know, our first book was The Great Boom Ahead back in 1992, and we foresaw an incredible boom when most people were pessimistic, and we saw the collapse of Japan, and it's all about demographics, that that there's been this massive baby boom around the world, and the first one occurred. It occurred the earliest in Japan. So they had a whole real estate bubble and stock bubble and great boom. I mean, Japan, you know, became a rich country in 3 decades, the fastest of anybody in history, and then Japan just collapsed. Nobody saw that coming except for us, because in the 80s, I was looking at demographics and how people move up predictable spending cycles as they age, and you can literally project the boom and bust cycles in any major country in the world, you know, 46 years in advance for the peak in spending. So we saw the simultaneous fall of Japan in the 90s, and that the rest of the world would just see their baby boomers hit, you know, the optimum spending rates in the 90s, and then we'd have this great boom. So what this book is saying is, hey, you know, we've seen Japan peak, now we've seen the bubble start to burst in the United States. Europe is next, and you know, you can see country by country, more and more countries going to go off this baby boom decline in spending, this demographic cliff, we call it. And so, you know, governments have this point of view, oh, we just had this big accident, this subprime crisis, this debt crisis, you know, in 2008 and 9, and if we can just get over this, we'll be back to normal. No, we won't. Every 40 years we see extended downturns, like 1929 to 42, late 68 to late 82. We're talking 12 to 14-year downturns, the same thing we projected for Japan in 1989, that they would be down for beyond even the 90s. These things come predictably, and you can't just fight it with some free money. You can fight it short-term, but they're going to lose this game. Debt is only going up. And countries and more countries are aging faster. And the biggest surprise, two big surprises in the next couple of years, Germany has a demographic slide even steeper than Japan had in the 90s. And Japan had, you know, a unbelievable crash and downturn even when the rest of the world was booming. And China is the only emerging country that actually is already seeing demographic slowing. Their workforce is going to be slowing, already has. And China's bubble is going to burst, and there is no such thing as a soft landing after a bubble like this. China's got a bubble that I can't even compare to any other bubble in emerging countries or in developed countries in the past couple hundred years. So China, when it bursts, it's going to fall like an elephant, and there's not going to be a darn thing the Federal Reserve or ECB can do to counter that, because that you're going to see a real estate implosion that's going to make the Japanese one in the 90s look like nothing.
So, Harry, when you talk about China, it seems that China may have already started to see this bubble burst. I think the Shanghai Composite down top, you know, peak to trough anyway, about 40% year-to-date, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And then you're starting to see the real estate bubble unwind. So you're saying it's going to get worse.
What much worse? And the real estate bubble is the big thing. You kind of had like a sudden stock bubble when real estate started to flatten out and decline a bit. Everyday people suddenly started speculating in the stock market, and so you just had this like one-year bubble, and in literally two-thirds of the people opening up brokerage accounts and going on margin had a high school education or less. So this was the real dumb money, I hate to say it. And so that bubble, once you get a bubble burst 40%, it's over. And the Chinese government's doing the same thing the U.S. government did in 1929. We had a 40% crash in about 2.5 months, similar to this. And then they got brokerage firms. They pumped, you know, funneled a bunch of money to buy stocks through brokerage firms, prop it up, and that happened for a couple months, and then it just crashed again. So China has burst. But the big thing is the real estate bubble, because the Chinese save 50%, the average person, 70% for wealthy people of their income, and they put almost all of it in the real estate. They don't buy stocks and bonds like we do in mutual funds as much. So they're heavily invested in real estate. Shanghai real estate's gone up almost 7 times since 2000, you know, when our real estate bubble started. And so when this thing bursts, it's not going to be 40% or 50%. It's going to be 70, 80% probably. It's going to be probably the biggest bubble burst in our lifetime. And the Chinese, with all that excess wealth, just like the Japanese were doing in the late 80s, their bubble has allowed them to invest around the world, and they're the ones buying up London, you know, and New York, and L.A., and San Francisco, and Vancouver, and Sydney, and Singapore. All these bubble cities are going to crash when the Chinese stop buying, because the Russian, Arabs, and Brazilians, the other big foreign buyers, have already slowed down because they've gotten killed by the commodity crash.
So, Harry, when you talk about China and you talk about demographics, one of the things that came to mind was the fact that China for so many years had a one-child policy. To what extent has that policy contributed to this decline?
Well, that's exactly it. That's the reason they are the only emerging country. Most emerging countries don't peak in their workforce growth and spending trends till 2040 to 2100 for Africa. So China is the odd country out because they had this one-child policy. And that dated back. It was informal in the early 70s, and then it became, you know, like rule of law late 70s. So that is, you know, on a lag, that is what's hitting them now. Their workforce growth peaked in 2012 and is slowly starting to shrink, and then about 2025, they go off a cliff just like Japan. And I'm saying, and again, my strongest predictions for China, they have overbuilt their economy by pushing people from rural to urban areas too fast, building condos for nobody. 27% of condos in Chinese cities are just sitting there vacant, empty, and owned by some semi-wealthy person who's not even renting it out. It's just absolutely crazy. They've overbuilt everything, industrial capacity, roads, bridges, railways. 10 to 15 years out, by the time they recover from this overbuilding bubble, they will be declining in aging as fast as Japan did in the 90s forward. So China has further urbanization down the road. They're not fully urban yet, but they are not going to be the growth story, and they are going to, I believe they're going to be the biggest bubble burst, and they're the ones already bringing down the emerging world and commodity prices, because the Chinese manufacturing machine and their people buy 40 to 50% of all the industrial commodities in the world. So China's a big deal, and you know, we've had slowing in you know, North American and European economies, and we've been using endless quantitative easing to kind of keep that at bay. But like I say, if this China real estate bubble blows, it's going to set off a chain reaction around the world, and there's not anything that quantitative easing in the U.S. and Europe can do. So this is what's going to blow the whole thing of banks trying to keep basically an economy that's already dead and peaked and try to keep bubbles alive, which only really benefits the top, you know, 0.1 to 1% to 10% of people who own most of the assets. So this is why most surveys I see, they survey the average person, they're like saying, what recovery? You know, we never came out of the recession from their point of view.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're chatting today with Mr. Harry Dent about his book, The Demographic Cliff. He is offering the listeners today a free copy of The Demographic Cliff. You need to pay only $4.95 for shipping and handling, and you can request your free book at harrydent.com. Harry, we've got just a couple minutes left in this segment. How will the average American listener listening to this program be affected, in your view, when China's real estate bubble bursts in earnest?
Well, you know, they'll be impacted. We're going to have, and we've been saying this for years, we had the first wave down in real estate. That was kind of like stopped by quantitative easing. And now we're going to have the second wave. When bubbles burst, they typically go back to where they started. Real estate is still well above the early 2000 levels when the bubble started in most countries around the world, and certainly in the United States. So that's what's going to impact. When the stock market goes down, the average person doesn't own a lot of stocks, especially after two big crashes that scared them out. But most people do own real estate, and we're going to see a deeper real estate crash. And around the world this time, it's not going to be just Spain or just U.S. or just Ireland. You're going to see bubbles burst around the world, and that's what's going to hit the banks the hardest, and that's what hits the everyday person. You get underwater on your house is worth less than your mortgage. Not only have you lost money and you're in trouble, but you can't even refinance to take advantage of lower interest rates. So that's the big thing I see. So we've been warning against real estate. Everybody thinks you can't go wrong long term in real estate. Japanese real estate, I always say, watch Japan. They've already gone through what we're going through. Japanese real estate is still down 60% residential 24 years after the peak, because there's now more older people dying who are sellers than younger people coming up and buying. So real estate will never be the same in an aging society. Young people buy homes, largely between age 27 and 41. That's what almost all the homes are bought. So when you start aging past that, like the baby boom is doing in most countries, and especially in Japan, there's just no demand for houses, and old people keep dying and selling them.
I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the pleasure today of chatting once again with best-selling author, Mr. Harry Dent, author of The Demographic Cliff. If you're just joining us, Harry's offering the listeners a free copy of the book, The Demographic Cliff. You pay just $4.95 to cover shipping and handling, and you can make your request at harrydent.com. Harry, let me jump in and pick up kind of where we left off in the last segment, and we were talking about real estate. Is it your take then that we are in another real estate bubble here in the United States, and that we're going to see a decline akin to what we saw 10 years ago?
Yeah. It's a second bubble. We haven't gone to new highs in most places, although Miami is and San Francisco, certain places. But yes, we never really got to fully deleverage the bubble because, again, government stepped in with massive quantitative easing. Mortgage rates are at least 2 percentage points lower than normal. That's a free gift to everybody that buys a home or refinances. Even my car loans are now 2% when they used to be 5%. So, it has created a less extreme bubble, but we still have a long way to go. Just to get back down to January 2000 prices, where I documented the bubble started, where things started to go up exponential instead of normal with inflation, we'd have to fall another 40-50%. So I mean, last time we fell 34%, and look how much turmoil that caused with underwater mortgages and how much banking problems and stuff and how much bailouts and stuff. So real estate, and throughout history, show that when you have a stock bubble burst, like the tech bubble or even the 29 bubble at first, stocks don't affect people as much. When real estate is at the center of a bubble, as farm real estate was in the 1920s bubble and in the 1830s bubble when everybody moved to the Midwest and Chicago became a big city, and when real estate's at the heart of speculation in the bubble, it has a bigger impact on everyday people and a much bigger impact on the banking system. So this is, if you thought 2008 and 2009 were bad, this is going to be worse because we've only kicked the can down the road 8 years here. So kicking the can down the road always kicks you harder when you finally face reality. So we're saying, one of the things we look at, Dennis, the markets, the stock market has a very clear pattern that everybody's ignoring on Wall Street. Each bubble has taken us to higher highs, 2000, 2007, and now in 2015. And each crash that's followed has taken us to lower lows. So if we went to like 6,400 something last time in the Dow, we're saying we're going to go to 5,500 to 6,000 next time and go from 18,000 something instead of 14,000. So I literally see like a 60-70% crash in stocks, much worse than 2008 and 9. And I think that's going to happen between now and early 2017. It's not going to take long because bubbles burst much faster than they build.
Harry, when you talk about the real estate bubble and talk about the fact that we're looking at maybe a 40-50% decline in real estate in your view, and then you look at the fact that we've got FHA-backed mortgages now with very little down for those with very low credit scores.
They're doing it again.
Aren't we repeating the same thing, and are we going to see more banking failures moving ahead, and will that be the catalyst for this stock market decline?
You know, well, they both feed on each other. The stocks will go first, and then real estate will follow and make the whole recession and downturn worse, and that will cause stocks to get hit harder. So in the same thing, now it's the opposite. You know, in China, the same thing. Stocks are bursting first. What you'll expect on a lag is real estate. Same thing happened in Japan. The stock burst happened about a year before real estate burst, but it was real estate that really brought Japan down and made this endless kind of deflationary recession they've been. They've been in a coma economy ever since, despite unbelievable levels of quantitative easing since 2013. So it's the real estate that really makes it serious, and real estate tends to take longer to find a bottom. Real estate peaked in early 2006. We were calling that in late 2015 in our newsletter. Very few people saw that coming. It took 6 years to find a bottom in 2012. And, of course, it's been bouncing back ever since. So this could be several years that real estate is falling. And that the best thing people can do is lessen their exposure to real estate. We have a lot of friends our age that are sitting in big homes, and their kids have left the nest, and they're thinking about downsizing when they retire. I said, downsize now. If you're going to move from a 4,000-square-foot house to a 2,000-square-foot townhouse, do it now. You'll cut your exposure to real estate in half. I have been renting in Tampa, Florida, ever since October 2005, when we were warning the bubble was about to burst, and I have saved a ton of money. I saved $1 million loss, and my rent has been half of what my mortgage and property tax payments would have been. So we benefited. I mean, real estate's great when things are going up, but when it's going down, it's an expense. And, you know, in our house, we probably avoided $40,000 of things, you know, failing that the landlord had to pay for that we didn't. So we're actually happy renting.
Harry, let me ask you, you know, moving ahead, what will Fed policy be? It seems like if we see another stock market crash, we see a real estate crash, that the Fed's going to try to go back to the well and maybe print again. And yep. will that mean that we're headed toward a hyperinflationary environment, or are we still going to see deflation? How do you come down on that argument?
You know, it's still deflation, because deflation is the trend. Young people are inflationary because they cost everything and produce nothing. Older people downsize everything. They spend less. They borrow less. They pay down debt. They even eat less. People weigh the most at 60 and then lose weight. And then, of course, they die at some point. All of this is deflationary. And Western societies and wealthy countries are all tipping towards this. But the other thing that causes deflation, even more so in history, when you have a debt bubble, and that always leads to financial asset bubbles, stock bubbles, real estate bubbles, commodity bubbles, all that sort of stuff, when those bubbles burst, debt deleverages, loans fail, money disappears, wealth in bubbles disappears and doesn't come back for a long time. And that disappearance of massive amounts of money, and the only time we saw that in modern history was in the Great Depression, back in the last century, you get deflation in prices. So all this quantitative easing that the gold bugs keep saying, it's going to cause inflation, going to cause inflation, hyperinflation, hyperinflation. No, they're just fighting. They're just counteracting deflation. They're trying to keep deflation from setting in, because when it does, as Ben Bernanke knew from studying the 30s, when deflation sets in, you have your worst economies. I mean, the inflation, we had the highest inflation in modern history in the 70s, and that was a difficult economy and recessionary. But nowhere near as difficulty, and no, and twice the unemployment in the Great Depression in the 1930s. And stocks went down 89% in the 1930s instead of, you know, 50 to 70 in the 70s. So deflation is what I call the winter season. It's the most challenging. But if investors understand, if you just get out of the bubble, you can short stocks if you want to take more risk, but that, I want people to sleep in it. Just get out of the bubble, put your money in safe stuff, let these crashes happen, and next thing you know, you're buying your dream home on a beach for 20 cents on the dollar, or you're buying, you know, leading stocks for 20, 30 cents on the dollar. That's how you make money in deflation, is you get out of the way and you rebuy after the crash, like Joseph Kennedy. He made a family fortune in a matter of years by taking money from legging business cash flow and getting out of the markets and buying back at the bottom of the Great Depression. So that's what you have to do, unfortunately. People keep saying, well, what can I invest in? Where can I get a good yield? You're not going to get a good yield unless you go into junk bonds, and then junk bonds fall as bad as stocks do, just as they did in 2008 and 9. They were down 50, 60% like stocks. So you have to be in safe treasuries and stuff like that, get little or no yield. But then every time things fall, you're actually making money because you can buy it 10, 20, 30 cents on the dollar.
So, Harry, last question. Seems based on the conversation we just had about banking that parking your money in a bank, you should at the very least be careful. Where would you suggest someone move for safety? Where do you park this cash?
What you do, you know, you have to have a checking account. Don't have a minimum amount just to do your business and pay your bills in a checking account, and then put everything else in a brokerage account. It can be a brokerage account at a bank or a brokerage firm or an online, you know, brokerage firm, or Charles Schwab, or anything. Have it in a brokerage firm in your name. The reason is, you put money in a bank account or a savings account, banks can lend against that. They call it reserves. They can lend 10 to 1 against the 10% reserve of your deposits. They're lending against your money, and if they lose money in this real estate crash, they may turn around, like a lot of banks did in the Great Depression, and say, you know, we say we have your money, but we actually don't have it. We lost it. So They can't lend that money if you have it in a brokerage account in your name, and then you get in safe stuff in that brokerage account, and when things start to crash, you start buying stuff at bargain prices years from now in an investment account, not in a savings account.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Harry Dent. He is the author of the book, The Demographic Cliff. If you'd like to get a free copy of The Demographic Cliff, all you have to do is pay $4.95 shipping and handling. You can make your request at harrydent.com. And Harry, thanks for joining us today. We'd love to have you back.
Okay, great being back.
As we close today's program, let me remind you that on next week's program, joining me will be Mr. Mish Shedlock. Mish is a very prolific researcher and writer. I'm going to get his take on world events and how it relates to the economy and your money. I know you're going to enjoy my conversation with Mish, which is always a very colorful conversation and also very informative. And let me remind you that we do have coming up on January the 30th, our next new retirement rules class. We are revising it for the new year. So mark your calendar, plan to attend if you've not yet attended. There will be information posted at newretirementrules.com if you would like more information. Again, the website is newretirementrules.com. And if you'd like to listen to the Everything Financial Radio program in podcast form, it is available each week at the iTunes Store. You can just search under Everything Financial Radio and become a subscriber to the Everything Financial Radio podcast. Or if you'd prefer, you can visit the website everythingfinancialradio.com. That's where our show is posted each week. And a final reminder, if you are not yet a subscriber to the Portfolio Watch newsletter, it is easy to become a subscriber. It is also free. All you have to do is visit the website, yourretirementoutlook.com. The website, again, is yourretirementoutlook.com. And when you sign up, we'll be glad to send you each week on Monday our free analysis of what's going on in the markets and what's going on in the economy. We get terrific feedback on our newsletter from our subscribers, so why not become one? Again, the website, yourretirementoutlook.com. That's our program for this week. Hope you got something you can use. Bye.